and what they call the ongoing drama.
We are sick of such protest and unrest. Our lives and properties are not safe. Political parties should resolve their issues in the parliament instead of disturbing our lives on the streets.
While apologizing the masses over the current political uncertainty in the country, the government asked the PTI-led provincial governments in Punjab and Khyber Pakhtunkhwa provinces to play their role in opening the roads to ease the life of the masses.
I apologize to the people affected by Imran Khan's long march and protests on behalf of the federal government. We strongly requested the provincial governments to open the national highways immediately.
Khan's party has announced that its anti-government march will be resumed on Thursday at the place where Khan was attacked.
The recent attack on former Pakistani Prime Minister has deepened the political standoff between the government and the opposition. Experts believe the country's political atmosphere would be more charged and violent in days to come. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
Petra Bass-Lipp is the mother of Alina Lipp, a journalist whom the German government is trying to imprison due to her reporting in Donbass. Like her daughter, she has fled Germany to Crimea due to persecution. The government recently arbitrarily closed her bank account.
First her bank account, then her father's bank account, and last mine. So, yeah.
And what does that do, closing down your bank account?
What does it... You must imagine, you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So... what to do?
And the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case. They just didn't even tell you, they just shut it down.
No, they didn't tell me. No, nothing.
And how did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lipp for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's move impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us maybe also. It's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of a suppressive state, or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects by the Ukrainian SBU, For Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with eight other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical, and for example, on the Ukraine issue, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch will stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
US President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the US cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of US presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation.
People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Mirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the Eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
Peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Geo Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark. But 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Geo Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week, when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity.
An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows keep pouring into the old continent for the greed of those who exploit asylum seekers for profit in and outside Europe. Max Civili, Rome.
In the limelight.
The idea that the U.S. democracy is increasingly broken was evidently seen in midterms. Based on an analysis of Federal Election Commission, 465 American billionaires have pumped over $881 million into federal midterm races, with the top 20 donor households giving 73% of the contributions, or collectively more than $643 million. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Global Times wrote, Insider and several other news organizations have identified 74 members of Congress who have recently failed to properly report their financial trades, as mandated by the Stop Trading on Congressional Knowledge Act of 2012, also known as the Stock Act, which prohibits the use of non-public information for private profit. This followed the 2020 congressional insider trading scandal that happened at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S., and several members of the U.S. Senate were caught making stock trades after being briefed about the coronavirus and the massive impact it would have upon the economy, jobs, and the stock market. Each of these scandals resulted in zero conviction by the Department of Justice. Some members suffered short-term political misfortune, but this was marginal at best. The reality is that members of Congress, including the country's third highest-ranking official in the U.S. government, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, are reportedly frequently engaged in such acts and are never brought to justice for any crimes they commit. There are a number of points to elaborate on this that are relevant to the upcoming midterm congressional elections. For one, the entire U.S. political system encourages corruption because politics is essentially reduced to money. Being able to outspend political opponents is an accurate predictor of electoral success, which is basically the most important factor in any election. The way that campaign finance laws are structured, especially the landmark 2010 Citizens United case that now equates money with free speech and legalized so-called dark money, means candidates and sitting politicians spend the vast majority of their time asking people, particularly wealthy people, for money. Naturally, this leads to pay-to-play schemes and political favors being accounted for. Some political scientists in the U.S. have thus argued for publicly financed campaigns to ameliorate this issue, which is already the norm. For example, in Germany and other Western European countries, the status quo means, in a nutshell, that elections can be bought and that politicians find themselves indebted to the people that finance their campaigns. Secondly, being a member of Congress isn't profitable compared to private sector carriers and is in fact costly. Members of Congress make over six figures, but this isn't a high salary when they have to self-finance their accommodation both in district and in Washington, D.C., plus their travel cost. This further increases members' dependence on campaign contributions and prices average people out of political office. As Congressman Dan Kresna hinted, rather crudely, this means only people who are already wealthy can even afford these costs, or that politicians have to engage in unsavory business practices like insider trade to stay afloat. Of course, the extent of some members' wealth gains while in office, such as Speaker Pelosi, blows this totally out of the water. Clearly, they are using these traits to enrich themselves outright. The way the so-called democratic system is currently conceived in the U.S. leaves much to be desired, to say the least. What is clear as day corruption in most comparable Western countries is the standard working order in Washington. The U.S. political system not only provides incentives for politicians to enrich themselves while in office, but pretty much requires them to do so in order to even live a decent life. This has obvious drawbacks with regard to the quality of American democracy. Studies have shown that the U.S. democratic system is a functional plutocracy, for example, a government run by the wealthy. Likewise, the fact that elections can be purchased is an open secret. The courts have codified it and it's widely discussed by the public as well as openly in the media. This creates such a degree of cynicism that makes people lose faith in the system altogether. This, reflected in the high amount of eligible adults that don't vote, usually floating around half the voting age population in most elections, which suggests that elections in the U.S. do not reflect public opinion, not to even mention the utter baked-in issues such as the Electoral College. Common Dreams also reported Americans for Tax Fairness revealed recently that billionaires have poured hundreds of millions of dollars into campaigns this cycle largely to benefit Republican candidates. Frank Clement, executive director of Americans for Tax Fairness, declared a torrent of billionaire cash is drowning the U.S. democracy. Money talks when it comes to influencing candidates and winning elections, and the loudest voices by far are billionaires pushing for lower taxes so they can accumulate even greater wealth and have even more power and influence. Clement added, if we're going to have an economy that works for everyone, billionaires need to start paying their fair share. And if we're going to have a democracy that works for everyone, we need to greatly curb the influence of billionaire money in our politics. Based on an analysis of Federal Election Commission FEC data from Open Secrets, ATF found that through the end of September, 465 American billionaires have pumped over $881 million into federal midterm races, with the top 20 donor households giving 73% of the contributions, or collectively more than $643 million. Putting that into a national context, ATF tweeted that billionaires represent 2 millionth of a percent of the American population, but they are responsible for 7.4% of all political donations so far this cycle. The group's report highlights how unprecedented the findings are, explaining that $881 million was already a 44% increase in billionaire contributions over the entire 2018 midterm cycle, which totaled $611 based on an earlier ATF analysis. reflecting the GOP's enthusiasm for tax cuts that benefit wealthy individuals and corporations. ATF found that by a 3-2 margin, more billionaire cash is supporting Republicans, about 59%, than Democrats, about 39%, with most of the remaining 2% going to super political act committees, PACs, which can collect unlimited contributions from donors for backers of cryptocurrency and the Israeli regime. The takeaways align with Bloomberg reporting, which detailed recently. Citadel's Ken Griffin, Blackstone Incorporation Chief Executive Officer Steve Schwarzman, and Oracle Corporation founder Larry Ellison are among the billionaire Republican donors who have rapidly scaled up their political contributions this midterm election cycle, boosting the odds of a divided Washington for the next 2 years. The three men worth a collective $150 billion are among the 12 top political donors ahead of the elections, according to the most recent data from Open Secrets. Of that dozen, 10 are backing Republicans in a big way. They have spent a cumulative $338 million, up 250% from the 2018 cycle. If you look at the people who are given on the Republican side, Griffin and Schwarzman and the others, they're all historically Republican donors. David Tomasi, a founding partner at Chartwell, a strategy group, told Bloomberg, adding, "It's not like this is their first rodeo with giving. It's just got more weight behind it."
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Thank you.
The U.S. midterm elections is upon the U.S., and the Republicans are almost certain that they will take back control of Congress. Meanwhile, this has been called one of the most important elections because the U.S. has never been so polarized. How severe is this polarity, and will it impact these elections? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why many Americans may not even accept the election results, an approach used by the former U.S. President Donald Trump, which has given rise to what's called political violence. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker joins us. He's an anti-war activist at the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat, who joins us from Belgrade.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. James Jatras, first over to you. So we have the midterm elections. What do you think? They say it's going to be all about the economy, since Americans are dealing with inflation and high living costs. How much do you think the vote is going to be about that or about the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think those two things go together. The fact that we have a totally incompetent president that's visible for the entire world to see, plus a very bad economic situation and inflation by all accounts, should mean a fairly decent night for the Republicans. And not only would the Republicans certainly take the House of Representatives, but very likely would take the Senate at all. But I think there are a lot of signals being sent, particularly by the Democrats, that that may not happen. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't sound like a man who expects to do badly in these elections. Rather than making his pitch to the American people, rather a few days ago, he went out and essentially threatened them and saying that if people don't accept the results of these elections, they're basically fascists, or one of his officials was speaking to Congress and saying essentially they would be agents of the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians if they don't accept the elections because they're fascists. It's very, very strange that somebody who by all rights should be expecting to do badly in an election is in a position of threatening his political opponents as, in essence, foreign agents and traitors if they question the election results. And I think we're already seeing some indications, for example, in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, which, again, by all rights, the Republican Mehmet Oz should win, that Mr. Fetterman, his opponent, the lieutenant governor, who's you know, again, it makes even Joe Biden look like a competent person, is saying that he expects the Republicans to have a really good turnout today, but over the next days or even weeks, that he expects to come out on top. So I think there's a lot of very interesting and concerning signals that are being sent.
What do you think about what our guest there from Belgrade, James Jatras, is saying there, Richard Becker, in terms of how Joe Biden has said what he said? I'm sure you heard him. What do you think that means?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I'm not a supporter of Joe Biden, but I don't think Biden was threatening to manipulate the election results. I think that has been the Republican strategy over a long period of time, is to put people into place, such as secretaries of state, which there's a secretary of state in each state of the United States, and they are responsible in most cases for running elections. The Republican strategy has been to get people into those positions who have taken the position that the 2000 election was illegal, that it was not, the outcome was manipulated, and so forth. So, I mean, the problem with Biden and the Democrats is that they have they've squandered their opportunity to a very large degree. They they have, since the Democrats took control of the House and Senate as well as the White House in the 2000 election or following the 2000 election, they have failed to do what they said that they were going to do. They failed to carry out a program that could have really won them the support.
Why do you think that happened?
Unbeatable majority. And they, because instead of being able to carry through that agenda, they focused on things like Russia Gate, so-called. I mean, these kind of ridiculous things. And that they have, as a party, are so divided among themselves that they've been unable to pass the program that had been proposed to relieve the suffering and meet the needs of the people.
Well, when you say a party that's divided, and you talk about how they've had their chance, and that now there's a missed opportunity because, as you mentioned, the focus on Russia. What issues are they divided on that stands out so glaringly? So, as you, for you to say that, I mean, in that respect, then this party, even if they retain the House of Congress, they're not going to be able to move forward that well if what you're saying is true.
Well, you know, what they're not divided on is war. The so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress, in a very mild statement a few weeks ago, where they first of all said that they were they praised Biden and the White House and the Pentagon for pouring weaponry into the to Ukraine to carry out what is really a U.S. NATO proxy war against Russia, and they said, well, maybe we should have negotiations too. And they were attacked by their leaders of their own party. And these are all Democrats. They were attacked by the leaders of their own party for even suggesting that there should be negotiations instead of all-out military campaign until victory.
Sure.
At the cost of every, unlimited numbers of Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Sure. Well, this notion of democracy is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden said on the eve of the U.S. midterms. And the statement that he made is, we know in our bones that our democracy is at risk. And we know that this is your moment to defend it. So let me, James Atross is back. James Atross, Joe Biden's statements about democracy, how it's, we know in our bones that that it's at risk. And it kind of goes along with what you said, James Atross. But you would think that the stance that you made, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is something that the Republicans would kind of say, alluding to voter fraud, I'm guessing, based on some of the statements. How do you see the statement by Joe Biden vis-a-vis, of course, the Republican stance altogether?
Well, I took it as a threat. You see, here's what the paradox is that Biden is calling his enemies extremists in every respect. And the fact of the matter is, even if most Republicans think this, wrongly or rightly, even if most Republicans think there was corruption in this election and the election was stolen, just as many of them think that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are not going to go out on the street and burn things down the way Democratic supporters burned the country down in 2020 during the BLM riots. So there's this interesting paradox where one side engages in violence and has no consequences for it. The other side doesn't engage in violence, but is treated as enemies of the people. We've seen, for example, the politicization of the FBI and of the justice system to basically take care, to treat opponents of the Biden regime as enemies. And I think, as you started the program, this is an indication of just how polarized this country has become. But the fact of the matter is, one side is using violence and using the politicization of the law enforcement structures of the federal government against its political opponents. The other side,
which side?
To have no way to really deal with that.
Which side is doing that, James Atross?
I think the left is doing that. The Biden regime and its supporters are doing that against their opponents.
Richard Brecker, I see you shaking your head. It's interesting that James Atross says the Biden regime, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were, after the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, there were demonstrations in more than 5,000 cities and towns in the United States. Less than 0.01% of those had any kind of violence, and there was no violence that ended up with people dead except at the hands of the police. And so now, on January 6th, that was not the left that stormed the Congress. That was the right wing, and that and led by fascist forces like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They played a key role in that. I mean, this is your other guest is presenting a new falsification of history. And the reality of it is that the violence that's being threatened now is violence that's coming from the right. And it's people out like today in Arizona with automatic weapons at polling places intended to intimidate people and prevent them from voting. That's happening in many places across the country. That's what's the real threat of violence is coming from the fascists.
James Ross, go ahead.
Well, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about at the beginning of this program. Americans simply do not live in the same country anymore. We have a very polarized society where we are effectively morally aliens to one another, if not enemies. And there's nothing that's going to change that through an electoral process. And the fact of the matter is, I have to dispute what my opponent says, that the 2020, during those mostly peaceful riots that burnt out the middle of many American cities, about 60 people died, and they were not killed by the police, who basically allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do in Democratic-controlled cities. Only one person died on January 6th, and that was an unarmed woman shot by a policeman.
Richard Becker.
You know, here you have a mass movement, the largest mass movement in U.S. history. 34 to 35 million people participated in those protests, and they were not riots. They were protests against police brutality.
They were riots. And by
that's
the way, the police did not kill George Floyd.
And you can't change
that. He was a criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose. Everybody knows this.
Richard Becker.
Oh. Really, it wasn't the knee on the throat.
No,
the
because he was saying I can't breathe while he was still standing up and not getting in the police car. He's saying I can't breathe, I can't breathe while he was standing there. Somebody who can't breathe is not saying I can't breathe.
Okay, so we're seeing right now the breakdown amongst you two to be representative. I'm guessing a mirror image of what many Americans think about each other. And it's interesting that you say it's not that James Atrasi said that you were living amongst aliens in the States, as you mentioned, but you're living in another planet. How did it get to the point where the polarization is not so much an exchange of thoughts as what many polls are indicating that this has to involve some kind of violence? And the reference is being made to the most recent incident that happened with Nancy Pelosi's husband. I mean, where does that line get crossed where violence comes into the picture in the States in this case?
It's clearly the right
wing. Who is that director?
I'm sorry. This is for James Dutras. Richard Becker, I'm sorry. I'm going to come to you with that same question. James Dutras, go ahead.
Well, I think let's take this Pelosi thing for an example. All the indications we've seen is that this unhinged gentleman who was caught in this very odd situation with Mr. Pelosi was some kind of a LGBT nudist activist of some sort, very much on the left wing if he had any politics at all. He seems to be a rather flaky individual. What kind of relationship, if any, he had with Mr. Pelosi, I don't know. Yet this is somehow being turned into by the mainstream media, which is essentially regime media that's in the pocket of the big corporations that, oddly enough, left-wing people in this country now support because it supports all their rainbow, homosexual, transgender agenda, which they want to impose on this country and, let's be honest, on the rest of the world. That somehow we've got woke capitalism in a kind of a fascist relationship with a left-wing regime that wants to suppress the American people who are mostly passive, are not doing anything, are not threatening violence, but are being accused of being violent extremists.
You know, there's some points
that's
of views there.
In this position.
Thank you, James Atrasi. Richard Becker, some points of views there that James Atrasi has relayed, from LGBTQs to, if I said that correctly in that order, to the other opinions that he just said. And again, these are things that he said that the left-wing regime, I guess, is what you said, is being exercised on the Americans. Do you feel that way? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. And the person who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband was a left-wing conspiracy theorist of who they are, who evolved into a right-wing, an extreme right-wing conspiracy theorist. And that's why he carried out the attack that he did. And that's why he carried out what he was hoping would be an attack on Nancy Pelosi. And again, I'm not a supporter of Nancy Pelosi or the Democratic Party, but I think that there's no question that's what happened. And this idea right. that there's a homosexual agenda is complete. That's a theory that has no
Richard
basis
Becker, quick
in
question.
Scientific reality.
Why isn't anybody for Nancy Pelosi? It seems like that's something that's been going on for quite some time.
Well, she has her supporters. As I said, I'm not a Democrat, but there are, you know, there's a very large Democratic Party that does support Nancy Pelosi. And the person who attacked her and who sought to attack her and did attack her husband was not from the left. He was a person who had been persuaded by these conspiracy theories that somehow there was this agenda that was going on and it was meant to turn everyone into pedophiles or something. I mean, it's complete garbage. It's just ridiculous garbage. But mm-hmm. that's what's being passed around as a real political outlook.
James Dutrois, go ahead if you have a reaction.
Yeah, it's a conspiracy. Huh? Just Google drag queen story hour. Just Google family-friendly drag queen shows and seeing what's being normalized in American schools, telling kids that they should dress up or transition, as they say, into another sex. This is being supported by the Biden regime. I do call it a regime, by the corporations. And this is America's agenda abroad. This is what we're trying
percentage?
To force on countries. We talk about countries like Ukraine, for example, talking about countries in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, where I am at the moment. This is the kind of agenda that this sick regime is trying to push on the American people and on the rest of the world. And a lot of ordinary Americans don't like it. My only complaint is, we don't know what to do about it because we're talking about honest, law-abiding people, family people, married people with kids, church-going people who don't like these kind of values.
James Dutrois, when you say that, what percentage, if you were to take a guess, unless you know a solid fact from a source, does America fall into the lines that you just said that are for or against what you said?
Well, see, that's the trouble. I think we don't really know. I think, unfortunately, it basically breaks down to about half and half with more extreme elements on either side. I would say more people on the right side are basically just sort of normal people who just want to live their lives and not accept this agenda. Is that a majority of the population? Probably not anymore. Maybe 35, maybe 40% of the population, but maybe another 10 or 20% will vote along with them. Same thing on the other side. I'm sure you have some very radical fringe on the left that espouses all of these values, but another 30, 40% of the population will vote along with them because they think they're voting for compassion or tolerance or any of these things. But the bottom line to me is that which side is the big money and the political power on? It's on the side of the left.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that Richard Becker, obviously, that James Dutrois said, I'm sure would not fly in San Francisco. But since we just have a few minutes left over here, let's move on to the foreign policy arena and see what's going to happen there. I mean, if all indications come out to be true in terms of the Republicans taking control of the Senate or the House or both, what are we looking at when it comes to, for example, issues like Iran?
Well, unfortunately, there is a bipartisan foreign policy of the United States, and it's an imperialist foreign policy. And so we have Trump having, in regard to Iran, having shut down, walked out of the JCPOA unilaterally, really a violation of that treaty. We have Trump having increased the imposition of sanctions, 243 new sanctions on Cuba, causing great suffering to the people, and increasing the sanctions on Iran, doing the same thing. But then you have Biden, who when he was running, said he was going to change those policies, and he has not. So there's no new JCPOA. There's still sanctions on Iran. There's a maintenance of the sanctions blockade against Cuba. And there is a foreign policy that is getting bipartisan support for the U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, a war that really threatens the whole world with nuclear destruction, and a war that needs to come to an end. And can only come to an end, not based on a decision by Zelensky, who I think is the president of Ukraine, who I think is just a puppet, but it's the refusal of the U.S. and NATO to negotiate, going all the way back to last year, when there was an opportunity for that. and instead has fueled this war. And that's a Republican and Democratic joint project.
Keep hearing about Republicans, James Atras, that are going to tone down the aid, military aid or assistance overall, perhaps, to Ukraine. Are we really looking at that happening? Were they to take control?
No, I don't think so. And this is where I do agree with my colleague on the program, is that we do have two warmongering parties. And even though I think there will be more Trump-type mega populists who are being demonized by the other side, they really are the only ones that might be somewhat opposed to some of this stuff, but even they will be a tiny minority in the Republican office holders. The leadership will be even more warmongering than the Democrats are. And of course, the left wing of the Democratic Party that used to be a peace wing of the Democratic Party has totally collapsed. We had that fiasco a few weeks ago where a number of left-wing members, you know, the progressive bloc in the House, had written urging, just mildly urging negotiations, and were forced to retract it because their betters in the party, I guess, held them down. So it's really sad. We have some populist right opposition to these things, but it's very small, and it's not really going to have much of an impact. My only fear is that the Republicans take the Congress, that they'll simply demand even more money for Ukraine, more militancy in global affairs. So, unfortunately, I think my colleagues, he and I agree on this.
Okay, final question. I see we have some time here. I'm going to go back to you had a UN special rapporteur say back in the year 2020, where he decried near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights. Richard Becker, electoral laws in some part of the U.S., like Texas, may undermine democracy by depriving millions of citizens the equal right to vote. Are we going to look at that happen perhaps this time, or is this a norm, or what do you think about this? Again, this was something that came out based on a report back in 2020.
It's very widespread, and it's aimed at particularly at black voters, also Latino voters, to restrict their access to voting. After years of trying to of expanding the access, now there have been in many states restrictions that have been put into place. And I think this is because the right wing can't really win the elections anymore if everyone gets to vote. You know who said that? Donald Trump. He said that a few years ago. He said, if we let everybody vote, the Republicans will never win another election. So the strategy is, let's shut down voting rights. Let's make voting more difficult. Why does voting even take place in the United States on a Tuesday, today? Why not and why isn't it a national holiday? So because it makes it so much more difficult.
Let me give 30 seconds to James Atras. James Atras, in closing, anything you'd like to say?
I would agree with my colleague on moving elections from Tuesday to a Saturday or a Sunday. If people agree with me that people to register to vote must not only provide proof of their identity, but proof of their citizenship, which simply does not happen. What he talks about, what ballot security measures are designed to make sure that people who are voting are actually citizens of the United States and actually who they are, they say they
Thank
are.
You.
Instead, what we get is the massive dumping of mail-in ballots,
right,
which is an open recipe for fraud.
Thank you, James Atras, former U.S. diplomat from Belgrade. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist, Answer Coalition, San Francisco.